You're listening to an OTB AM podcast. You can watch the show or listen live every weekday morning from 7:45 AM. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream for more stuff just like this.
Okay, so the Hurling for Cancer charity match is coming up on the 14th of August this year. It's on a new bridge in St. Connolly's Park. Throw-in is going to be at 6 o'clock on that occasion. And of course, it's all in aid of the Irish Cancer Society. It's been played every year now since 2012, and over €700,000 has been raised for charity in that time. I'm delighted to say legendary racing trainer Jim Bulger joins me in studio now this morning. Jim, how are things?
Very well at the moment, thanks. Yeah,
good stuff. So hurling for cancer, we must talk about this because it looks brilliant. It's Davy Russell's best against Jim Bulger's Stars, and looking at a little bit of the form lines going over the last few years, you've had the upper hand over Davy with four wins, I think, since 2012.
And a draw, but he got the better of us last year.
Right, so, okay, revenge this year then.
And he's gone out poaching now this year, and I see he's added a few that are going to make it very difficult for me.
Yeah, we'll stick up the teams online, but like there's obviously a slew of hurling legends when you look through those teams, but there's also a few other ones, like you can see Peter Canavan there, like you can see Tadhg Furlong and Willie Mullins among the umpires, for example, and
yes.
Miriam O'Callaghan, a sideline official. So it's a great lineup.
Yeah, well, they all very willingly give their time, and we very much appreciate that. You know, they're a great help.
They're also, for the most part, top class current or former athletes. I presume things get a little bit competitive in this annual match.
Yeah, we started out with more jockeys and more stable staff, but I don't know who cheated first, whether it was Davy or me, but we now have players from a lot of counties that have All-Ireland medals.
Yeah, absolutely. Hurling, of course, is something very close to your own heart as well. What did you make of Wexford's calendar year this year?
Well, sure, we gave it a good shot for a while, and probably a little bit unlucky maybe not to go further in the league. You know, they put up a good show on most occasions, but they're still a work in progress, and I'd say next year will probably be their breakthrough year.
Yeah, well, hopefully from a Wexford perspective it is. Like, I wanted to just mention as well, kind of going back a good while, because I remember a couple of years ago we had Ned Wheeler and Art Foley on the show talking about 1956 and beating Cork. Obviously, that was the double years, 55 and 56. Do you remember those two All-Ireland wins from Wexford's perspective?
Yeah, I started secondary school the day after they won the final in 55. That was the first one.
Against Galway?
Yes. And then the following year, they won a proper All-Ireland. They beat Cork. And at that stage, we were always worried about how we might get to the matches. It wasn't whether they were going to win or not.
Yeah,
they won everything for about 2 years. And then they had a bit of a break then when some of the older players like Nicky Rackard were giving up. And we won another All-Ireland then in 60. And then we had to wait 8 years after that. So in my time, Wexford have won five All-Irelands. So from a purely personal point of view, I'd be very happy with that, you know.
It's been pretty
good.
But
I'd like to see some of the younger people in Wexford, for them to witness what we witnessed as youngsters.
Yeah, anyone under the age of 21, 22 obviously wouldn't have seen it yet.
No, they wouldn't have, no. And it's amazing the way the years have flown by, yeah. You know, that they've gone a long time now without success.
It was all, like you mentioned the Rackards there, I presume, even just watching 56, like seeing the Rackards and Christy Ring on the same pitch must have been unbelievable. Yeah. And the legend has it that Christy Ring was actually carried off the pitch shoulder high, despite the fact that Cork lost that.
He was carried off by the Wexford Palace.
Yeah,
he was. The first inter-county game that I was ever at was probably in 54 or 55. And we went to the match by Pony and Trap in Wexford. And Christy Ring was playing with Cork that day, and Nicky Rackard, all the three Rackards were playing with Wexford.
How long did that journey take?
Not very long. We had a very good pony.
Right, okay.
About 45 minutes, I think. And we only saw two or three motor cars on the way in, and everyone else were on bicycles.
And was the fact that you had a good pony down to your own keen eye for a good horse at that point?
No. My father, sure. I was on an 11-year-old at that stage. But my father always had a good pony. He had a good mode of transport.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You obviously picked up the hurling when you were a kid as well. Like, how far did your hurling career, so to speak, last for?
Not very long. I hurled juvenile and minor, and I got one run with a senior team in Oilgate. They had a good senior team at the time. It was hard to get on it anyway.
Right.
And I came to Dublin then when I was 17, and I played a few games with the Father Murphys in Dublin and had a couple of outings with the Fogs, who had a very good team at that stage. I remember I was corner forward on a team probably in 1963 or 4, and Billy Dwyer was full forward, who's a former Kilkenny All-Star, and Niall Quinn's father,
right,
the late Billy Quinn, was in the other corner, and I know Mick Burns from Tipperary was on the same team. But
that's one hell of a cast.
I didn't last very long there. So I had a bad ankle, and that was my excuse.
Yeah.
So I retired at an early age.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I had one outing on Dan Quigley in Wexford, and he says that he's responsible for me being a racehorse trainer, that he sickened me as far as hurling was concerned. Yeah.
You mentioned your father there, and that's obviously your first introduction really to horses and looking after his mares, I think, while also studying in the College of Commerce. So there was a bit of a balancing act at one point in your life.
Well, that was after I came to Dublin. I went to the College of Commerce. Yeah, that was to try and get some sort of a respectability from an academic point of view, that I might be able to earn a few shillings and be able to buy a racehorse someday. But that didn't last too long anyway, and I decided in the end to go training.
Yeah, there must have been some sort of element of confidence that it was the right decision at the time, that you must have had some sort of talent that was being spoken about, that you realised, I can actually make this if I work hard enough.
Well, I didn't really know until I tried it.
Sure.
But I always had an alternative in mind, that if it didn't work. But I only thought about the alternative for about 6 months. We got off to a very good start. I got my licence in July of 76, and we had a winner fairly quickly. And then I had a double, a winner at Clonmel and a winner at the Curragh on the same day. And at that stage, then, you know, when somebody comes in from the outside like that and has two winners, people want to know who he is. And it began to happen from there then. And I had 22 then the following year. So we were up and running at that stage.
Yeah, it was a fairly kind of incremental increase over the years. And I presume the belief then starts to grow as well.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Confidence is a big thing in any sport or business. And we would have had it from a pretty early start, you know, that I was never in any doubt but that I would be able to do it and that we would be able to keep it going. But that meant working about 18 hours a day. So, you know, not everybody's prepared to do that.
You must have loved the 18 hours a day, though, because I think I've seen you say in the past that you wished you started focusing in on just the horses 10 years earlier.
Yes, yeah, well, I might have been able to give up by now, so, but in any case, I had a slight regret that I didn't start earlier, but it wasn't a big thing with me.
Yeah, it's interesting actually that you mention Dublin there, because just thinking about it now, you had to leave Dublin kind of in part due to the Pope, and which is obviously relevant speaking in the year 2018 now when he's about to come back to Dublin.
Yeah.
Well, is that true? What's the story there?
Yeah, well, we had to get, there was a public gallop in the Phoenix Park. It was at the back of the embassy. And we used to use that. We had to get a licence from the Board of Works to use it every year. And the late Christy Grassick and Paddy Cairns and myself and a few others used to use it. And anyway, when the Pope was coming, we were thrown out. So actually, it was a good thing because I had to do something about it then, so we went looking for a place at that stage. And we found Cool Cullen in County Kilkenny, and we've been there ever since.
Yeah, things worked out pretty well in the end. You can thank the Pope for that.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah. I did go down to see him in the park, along with a million others, and that was a great day.
Yeah. I did want to ask you about those early days in Cool Cullen, and I guess sort of the reputation that you had at the time, and a reputation that maybe you tried your best, I'm not sure, to to part with the idea that you were the best round of training fillies. And despite the fact that what seems to be a fact, when I listen to people who know what they're talking about, say it's much harder to train a filly than it is to train a colt. But it seems from what I've read that there was almost kind of a stigma attached to that, that you could only train a filly but not a colt, despite the fact that it was much more difficult.
Yeah, well, sure, it's the same in any sport, isn't it? You get people talking about hurlers or footballers who are only good when there's a cut in the ground. and if when the ground dries out, they're no use, you know. So a lot of it is only chat anyway.
Sure.
If you can train a filly, you can train a colt.
Like, maybe it happens a lot earlier than that, but you think about the 92 Irish Derby, and is that a moment when you think that kind of view of you as somebody who could only train a filly was kind of fully put to the rear window?
Well, I think when you train a Derby winner or have a champion two-year-old colt, it's accepted then that you can do either, yeah.
Mm. And at that point, in 92, was it a surprise for you? Obviously, you've been working extremely hard for a couple of decades before that to get this win. What did that feel like? I presume the idea that the change in your view wasn't actually in your head at the time. The most important thing was winning the Irish Derby.
Well, the big thing I remember most about it was that no Irish trainer had won the Irish Derby for some time before that. I think the previous one would have been Law Society, and that could have been 7 or 8 years before we won it. And, the general racing public were beginning to wonder, would an Irish trainer ever win it again? So when he turned into the straight in front anyway, and he was increasing the distance between himself and his followers all the time up to the winning post, they nearly took the roof off the stand at the Curragh. So everybody that was there, I think, were more pleased, or just as pleased and happy about it as I was.
Yeah, for sure.
He was a world champion that year.
Was he?
He was rated £5 above AP Indy, who was the best horse in America. And, when you think that there are 100,000 foals born every year, how lucky must you be to have the best one out of 100,000?
It's not luck, though, is it?
Well, you have to be in the right place at the right time. There has to be a certain amount of luck, you know, to get a horse like that. And I suppose then, you have to do the right thing with him.
So, yeah.
We were fortunate to be able to get the job done.
When you think about it, the right thing has been done a lot in Coolcullen down through the decades. When you think about it, like, how much does that culture of excellence, how long does that take to actually instill? Was it from day one when you thought to yourself, right, okay, this is going to be better than everybody else, this is going to be high on discipline, high on work rate, and we are going to produce some of the best jockeys, some of the best trainers that Irish racing will ever see? Or was that just kind of an unexpected consequence of trying to survive at the start?
Well, I always grew up with discipline. There were 8 of us in the family, and I think our parents were wonderful to be able to look after 8 of us at that time, and it wasn't easy, especially on a medium-sized farm. And when I went to school then, obviously there was a lot of discipline in schools at that time. And secondary school was the Christian Brothers in Enniscorthy, and discipline was high on the agenda there. And there was one teacher there who was huge into discipline but never raised his hand to anybody. He was the best teacher that I've ever seen or heard of. And nowadays he happens to be Colm Tobin's father.
Right.
Yeah, but at that stage he was just Micheál Tobin. And I think if you're exposed to discipline at that stage, it'll follow through for the rest of your life.
And that was something that you brought to Coolcullen?
Yeah, I brought that to the job then as well, yeah.
How does that manifest itself then? Is it kind of being hard when you need to be against certain people in the setup to certain apprentices?
No, you just lead from the front and then you expect others to follow suit and to look after their patch as well as you're looking after your patch.
Yeah.
And I when that happens, it's sort of automatic at that stage. And then, of course, you have to establish a reputation for being a no-nonsense person. So obviously there are times when you have to be firm, but that hasn't happened now in the last 25 years or so. the rep- the reputation goes a long ways, you know. Yeah,
it certainly does. Well, the reputations of the others that have worked under you have gone a long, long way as well, and are still continuing to go that way. And like, I often wonder, like, when you look at the likes of Tony McCoy, you look at the likes of Willie Mullins and Aidan O'Brien, I completely accept I'm only naming a fraction of the big names that have come out of the place. But was that deliberate from your point of view to actually nurture great talent, that there will be a legacy of Cúil Chulainn? Or was it more a sense that I want to be successful in the here and now, and whoever succeeds off the back of it, all well and good?
No, well, what happened in my case was that we had a reputation for doing things the right way. And then parents wanted to send their young sons or daughters to work with me because they knew that they'd be nurtured in the right direction. And that was precisely what happened. And luck came in there as well. I mean, how lucky do you have to be to meet people like that, that you can sort of bring along and direct them to a successful career in their own right.
Is there a common thread amongst that kind of potential greatness that you saw in the likes of O'Brien or Mullins?
Well, I know that I don't think of any of the ones that were mentioned, and you can throw in a few more there as well, like Kevin Manning and Billy Supple and his brother Robbie. They never had to be reprimanded at any stage about anything. It was amazing how they wanted to succeed themselves, and I don't think I ever had a crossword with any of those people in all the years that they were with me.
That's remarkable to hear, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
A self-discipline element then as well, I presume.
Yeah, well, the only time I had a difference with Anthony McKay was when he was leaving. He had broken his leg about 6 months earlier, and I felt that it was too soon to be going riding over fences in England, and that possibly whatever trainer he might be with wouldn't take care of him the way we had taken care of him. And anyway, I didn't succeed. So, and if you have him on the show sometime, he can tell you the whole story.
Yeah, I briefly recall him talking about a broken femur or something like that, and something about underestimating his pain threshold or something is what he said on the record about it before. But
yeah.
Like the other thing then, when you look at the flip side of things, where decisions where you can look back in time and say, well, I clearly got that one right, is with Galileo. Like, is it true that Aidan O'Brien didn't rate Galileo?
Well, he did rate him, but I think as a sire, he preferred High Chaparral.
Okay.
But I mean, anybody could, if you want to call it a mistake, could make that mistake. You know, that very few horses are successful at stud anyway. He felt that from the demeanour of High Chaparral that he might be a better sire. But in any case, he was pretty successful as well. But Galileo is phenomenal.
What did you see in him?
Well, I was very impressed with him. The first time I saw him run was at Leopardstown. And it was a maiden two-year-old race at the back end of the season, and he won as he liked, and I knew that he had a very good pedigree, and I felt that he was the horse to follow on then as a three-year-old, and maybe when he got to stud, John Magner might be kind enough to give me extended credit terms and I might be able to use them. So it all started from there.
Right, okay. We're almost out of time here. Just one other thing I wanted to chat to you about is just kind of the future of racing and today in racing. And I think maybe all through the decades of racing, the people who've trusted in youth have been rewarded for it. And you're somebody who's trusted in youth quite a bit. And I guess with racing, it's one of those sports that, unlike any other, you can put a trust in youth. There might be a naivety at times, but when it comes to pure talent, it's all about trusting that. And if you're trusting it early, you can get ahead of the game and you can look back in time and say, well, listen, I got that one bang on the money.
Yeah, well, you're talking about, when you're talking about youth there, you're talking about people.
Sure, yes.
Young fellas or young girls coming into me. Yeah, well, I'd like to think anyway that any young person who has come to me, that they've been able to reap their full potential. Whether it was just working with horses on a daily basis or making it to the track and being successful on the track. It's not easy to get going as a rider if you don't get up a few winners very quickly and try and get the confidence of your trainer or the people who are giving you the most rides at the beginning. But we've been fortunate in that the ones that showed ability, that we were able to nurture that ability, and they went on to great success.
They sure did. You mentioned there not having early success can be to your detriment. It's ruthless. It always has been. Do you think it's more ruthless now for somebody starting off than it was, say, 30, 40 years ago?
I wouldn't think there's much difference, really. You know yourself in all sports. If you don't shine when you get the big opportunity, it's hard enough to come back from that, you know. So if the young person has ability in whatever the sport is and they get a reasonable chance to show it, if it's really there and they have all the other ingredients that go with the talent, I think then they have a good chance of making it.
And then from your perspective, if the next Jim Bulger was to emerge now, or can the next Jim Bulger emerge in this current landscape? Can a self-made trainer become very, very top of the class and succeed beyond their wildest dreams? Can you see that happening now, or has money taken over to the point where being self-made is nigh on impossible?
I would hate to foist another Jim Bulger on the racing community. The opportunity is still there for young people starting out, but they need to be bankrolled nowadays.
Yeah,
because horses have got so expensive, and there's a huge demand for Irish horses all over the world, and you know it's very hard to pick up a bargain nowadays. Whereas when I was starting out, there were a few bargains around, but it's more difficult, much more difficult now. So any young people now that ask me about setting up as a trainer, I'd ask them, have they got £2 million? So it's a little bit like that. You need £1 million for your premises, and another million then that you're prepared to risk and put in the raw material yourself, and take the gamble and then prove to people that you can train horses. And when people see that you can do it, then they'll want to send horses to you. But even for reasonably successful trainer starting out, it's still difficult now. It's so competitive.
Of course it is, and it's flying high on an international level as well. Just a final mention again for Hurling for Cancer. It's on Tuesday, August 14th in St Connell's Park in Newbridge. Who's going to win it, Davy Russell's Best or Jim Bulger's Stars?
If I were a bookmaker now, I'd probably be making Davy favourite, because he's poached a few top hurlers there, and I'm not sure if we have the numbers to compete with him, but we'll give it a good shot.
Well, the very best of luck with it. We'll hope for an upset in a couple of weeks. Jim Bulger, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
So, if you like this, you'll probably also like OTB AM, Ireland's only sports breakfast show. Subscribe to the OTB AM podcast stream or catch the show live on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook or offtheball.com every morning from 7:45 AM.